This morning, we'll pick up our studies in the life of the man David with our talk this morning is going to be titled The Silent Dove Among Strangers. The Silent Dove Among Strangers. As you all might remember, it's been a while because we had some switching around of speakers, so it's been a while since I spoke. But we've been focusing on 1 Samuel 21. As David first fled to the tabernacle at Nob, then onwards to Gath, motivated by the fear of man. I will be honest that going into these studies, I never expected that we would discuss this particular chapter from so many angles. I think we've spent more time on this chapter than we did on 1 Samuel 17, which again has taken me by surprise. If you remember, though, the last two times that I spoke, we gave an overview of Psalm 34. Which David composed in the cave Adullam, as he looked back jubilantly on his salvation from Gath and exhorted his brethren in the fear of the Lord. So it was my intention originally to move on this morning, but as often happens while looking at something else, I stumbled onto yet another psalm and realized that I had omitted something from the study. So I'm surprised none of you all mentioned this to me, but we're going to cover Psalm 56 this morning, which is yet another psalm that's related to this particular subject. So looking backwards, if I had presented this subject correctly, I should have actually discussed Psalm 56 before Psalm 34. But here we are. So Psalm 34 was a reflective psalm from the cave Adullam, where David joyfully is praising Yahweh and teaching his brethren in the fear of the Lord. Psalm 56, we believe, was the actual prayer of David when the Philistines took him in Gath and when he had to play the madman. Humbled to the point of utter humiliation, the beloved turned to Yahweh, and the psalm before us details that prayer, which was later made into a song. This psalm also may have been written down in the cave Adullam along with Psalm 34, but its content predates the other. So, in any event, let's get into this psalm, and somewhat also unusually this morning, we're going to spend a good deal of time on the introduction to the psalm, probably as much time on the intro as on the psalm itself, because I think there's a lot in there. So if you look at we read Psalm 56 to open up this morning. If you look at the introductory phrase, so to speak, it says, to the chief musician upon Jonathullam Rukkakim, Miktam of David, when the Philistines took him in Gath. So we're going to go through this. There's a lot hidden in here. The Hebrew word Miktam is where we're going to start. It's mentioned in the headings of six Davidic psalms. Those are Psalm 16 and Psalms 56 through 60. So Psalm 16 and Psalm 56 through 60, they all have the Hebrew word Miktam of David associated with them. The latter group, Psalm 56 through 60, is a group of psalms that are dedicated to specific events from the journeys of David. If you turn through the pages, and we're not going to go through each of them, you will see that they are all dedicated as well to the chief musician, meaning that they were all later put into song, again, at a future point in David's life, once the sons of Asaph and other Levitical musicians were established. It is possible that they may have been written down earlier in a textual format, such as Psalm 56 may have been written in the cave, but later were adapted for singing. So why is the word miktam used in the headings? This word, which I'm probably mispronouncing, it means an engraving or a poem. An engraving or a poem, and it comes from a root that means to carve, to engrave, to inscribe indelibly, or mark. So given the context of when Psalm 56 was likely written initially, it seems very possible that it was first written down in the form of an engraving, perhaps even in the cave itself. More importantly, though, these were words, and I think this is the more important point, these were words engraved upon David's heart. The next verse we're going to turn to is an example, is in a negative context, but it proves the point. Let's look at Jeremiah 17, verse 1. Jeremiah 17, verse 1. The sin of Judah is written with a pen of iron and with a point of a diamond. It is graven upon the table of their heart and upon the horns of the altar. So again, very negative context here in Jeremiah. But in a positive context, the words of this psalm were written or graven upon the table of David's heart. And we're going to find as well that they were written or engraven upon the table of Christ's heart. There's much in here regarding the Christ, the Messiah. Okay, let's also look at Proverbs chapter 3, verses 1 through 4. Proverbs chapter 3, verses 1 through 4. My son, forget not my law, but let thy heart keep my commandments. For length of days and long life and peace shall they add to thee. Let not mercy and truth forsake thee. Bind them about thy neck. Write them upon the table of thine heart. Which are these things were for David. And then Proverbs 7, 1 through 3. My son, keep my words and lay up my commandments with thee. Keep my commandments and live. And my law is the apple of thine eye. Bind them upon thy fingers, write them upon the table of thine heart. So that was Proverbs 7, 1 to 3. So, in short, these various psalms that are called Mishptam, that are labeled as such, again, they initially, most of these, especially 56 through 60, were written initially during David's wanderings. They were initially carved and engraved or inscribed physically down. But more importantly, as David went through these events in his life, these were the thoughts that were inscribed upon his mind and heart. And so I think that's the best way to look at this, that he would ponder and later put to song, S-O-N-G, for use in the services of the temple and so forth. Okay. But we aren't done with our consideration of the heading yet. We're going to spend a significant amount of time on this interesting word, which is very hard to pronounce, Jonathelam Rechokim. It is written to the chief musician upon Jonathelam Rechokim. While it's very hard to say, this is a word that should not be overlooked. And there's a lot in this one word. If you just look at it in the initial Hebrew, and you try to break it down, the one word, for those of us who aren't true Hebrew scholars, when you look at it, the first thing you see is Jonah. Jonah. So the first part of this word is indeed the word Jonah, which means dove. So there's much agreement on the first part of this word, and then there's a little bit more variation regarding the latter part of it, which is the Rechokim, and I'll get back to the middle in a second. The Rechokim means something like strangers, remote distances, far off places. The middle part of the word is Elam, or that refers to silence or mute justice, as we'll get into. So putting these together, three suggestions, and again, there's vast agreement on the first half, maybe not as much agreement on the second half. The silent dove among strangers, which is what we titled our talk, the silent dove of remote distances, or the silent dove of far-off places. Regardless of what one settles on, the word is clearly referencing a silent dove who is out of place, far from where it had originated, amongst strangers. So I mentioned the word, the latter part of that word, Elam is the middle part of the word, getting tongue-tied here, can also be translated not only as silent, but as the phrase mute justice, the dove of mute justice. This might actually be the best translation, and I'll explain why. If you're like me, you probably have not heard the term mute justice before, but if you look it up, it is actually a legal term referring to when a prisoner, upon his arraignment or trial, refuses to answer, and thus a final judgment is made without a normal defense. So again, mute justice is a phrase, a legal term referring to when a prisoner, upon his arraignment or trial, totally refuses to answer, and thus a final judgment is made without a normal defense. So with these clues in mind, obviously there's much more to this engraving of David than meets the eye at first glance. It was David's prayer in a time of great trouble, in a time when he was, again, had basically played the part of a literal madman. He was essentially a dead man before Achish. Where was he? Remember, he had been captured by the enemy in Gath, meaning winepress, having been abandoned and cast out by the majority of the Jews. He was counted as their enemy, and now he was in the winepress of judgment. Yet this psalm, later put to music that Jesus himself was likely familiar with, was also a messianic message regarding the silent dove who was put into the winepress of judgment by his enemies and stood in mute justice among strangers. While we know the original context of the psalm, can we not see the spiritual symbolism that brings it to a whole new level? All right, so we want to dive into this a little bit more deeply than we've been so far. First, the dove. And I know Brother Mac has covered this extensively, so with the Song of Solomon studies, but we will look at some of these verses nonetheless. It is no wonder why the dove, a symbol of gentleness, humility, and peace, it becomes an apt representation of the beloved, of the undefiled. It figures predominantly in the symbols of Song of Solomon, as Brother Max has been guiding us through, but we're going to turn over there. For example, in Song 1:15, the bridegroom describes his bride as having the eyes of a dove, in Song 1:15. While we may struggle in our desire to be part of that prospective bride, to develop his characters, the characteristics of the groom, the groom deserves and desires to see the bride perfected as a dove in his eyes. Let's continue on with some other Song of Solomon verses. Let's look at Song 2:14. Song of Solomon 2:14. O my dove that are in the clefts of the rock, in the secret places of the stairs, let me see thy countenance, let me hear thy voice, for sweet is thy voice, and thy countenance is comely. Chapter 4, verse 1. Behold, thou art fair, my love. Behold, thou art fair. Thou hast dove's eyes within thy locks. Thy hair is as a flock of goats that appear from Mount Gilead. Chapter 5, verse 2. I sleep, but my heart waketh. It is the voice of my beloved that knocketh, saying, Open to me, my sister, my love, my dove, my undefiled. For my head is filled with dew, and my locks with the drops of the night. In chapter 6, verse 9. My dove, my undefiled, is but one. She is the only one of her mother. She is the choice one of her that bare her. The daughters saw her and blessed her, yea, the queens and the concubines, and they praised her. So we see that the bride here, described as a dove on the whole, and particularly that characteristic of the dove is associated with her eyes, which are singularly focused on the groom, the light of the world, as we see in Matthew 6:22. It would not surprise us, then, that the Song of Solomon also describes the groom as having the eyes of a dove in Song 5:12. So if the bride is supposed to copy the bridegroom or reflect the bridegroom, it makes sense that as the bride is referred to as the dove, so too is the groom. Song chapter 5, verse 12, describing the groom, His eyes are as the eyes of doves by the rivers of waters, washed with milk and fitly set. All right, let's go back to Song 2:14 just for another key point. O my dove, thou art in the clefts of the rocks, in the secret places of the stairs. Let me see thy countenance, let me hear thy voice, for sweet is thy voice, and thy countenance is comely. The doves are hidden in the clefts of the rock. This is where the bride and the groom both put their trust. Ultimately, the rock in Scripture is Yahweh, and then we also see this term ascribed to his own son. Let's look at a few verses on that. 1 Samuel 2, 1 and 2. 1 Samuel 2, 1 and 2. And Hannah prayed and said, My heart rejoiceth in Yahweh, my horn is exalted in Yahweh, my mouth is enlarged over my enemies, because I rejoice in thy salvation. There is none holy as Yahweh, for there is none beside thee, neither is there any rock like unto our God. 2 Samuel chapter 22, verses 1 through 3. 2 Samuel 22, 1 through 3. And David spake unto Yahweh the words of this song in the day that Yahweh delivered him out of the hand of all his enemies and out of the hand of Saul. He said, Yahweh is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer. The God of my rock, in him will I trust. He is my shield and the horn of my salvation, my high tower, my refuge, and my savior. Thou savest me from violence. So, we know from the scriptures, just putting these things together, the dove is a symbol, first and foremost, of Jesus himself, the bridegroom, and also of the bride that should be reflecting his characteristics. The doves put their trust in the rock. They dwell with the rock for their shelter, for their protection, as their salvation, high tower, and refuge. That rock is Yahweh. Of course, we know ultimately in the New Testament, Jesus is also referred to as the rock of Christ in 1 Corinthians 10:4. We also think of the parable of the wise man who built his house upon the rock in Matthew 7, 24 and 25. Looking at some other psalms real quick, we'll see that the dove bride, even when she seeks to fly away from the world as a stranger and sojourner, ultimately seeks peace with her rocks, the father and the groom. Let's look at Psalm 61, verse 2. Psalm 61, verse 2. From the end of the earth will I cry unto thee, when my heart is overwhelmed, lead me to the rock that is higher than I. Again, this Psalm 61 is a psalm of David. As David was writing Psalm 56, or actually at first sort of composed in his mind, he was in a time of desperation. He was himself as a silent dove among strangers, and he needed the rock to cry out to the rock of Yahweh, ultimately, who would deliver him and bring him into a literal rock of the cave. But here again, David is crying out, To the end of the earth will I cry unto thee when my heart is overwhelmed. Psalm 55, verses 4 through 7. Psalm 55, verses 4 through 7. This is another one of those psalms of Mashil, or the engravings upon David's heart. 55, 4 to 7. My heart is sore pained within me, and the terrors of death are fallen upon me. Fearfulness and trembling are come up upon me, and horror has overwhelmed me. And I said, Oh, that I had wings like a dove, for then I would fly away and be at rest. Lo, then would I wander far off and remain in the wilderness. Selah. All right. Since we're not intending to give an entire talk on the dove, I just have a few more points I wanted to get to as we connect these things specifically to Christ. We would be remiss if we did not bring up the fact that Jesus specifically referenced the dove over in Matthew chapter 12, verses 38 through 40. Matthew chapter 12, verses 38 through 40. Then certain of the scribes and of the Pharisees answered, saying, Master, we would see a sign from thee. But he answered and said unto them, An evil and adulterous generation seeketh after a sign, and there shall no sign be given to it, but the sign of the prophet Jonas. For as Jonas was 3 days and three nights in a whale's belly, so shall the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. So, in verse 40, we see this prophetic words of the 3 days and three nights that Jonas spent in the belly of the whale or the fish, compared to the sign of Christ coming, death, burial, and resurrection. But there is more to it than that. As we go back over to Luke, parallel account, Luke 11, 29 and 30. I'll just read verse 30. It says, "For as Jonas was a sign unto the Ninevites, so shall also the Son of Man be to this generation." So Jonas himself was a sign, and that's a whole other subject for another day. But connecting these things, what does Jonah's name mean? He is the dove. The dove was a sign unto the Ninevites. The dove was also a sign unto Christ's generation. Yes, there were specific events in Jonah's life, most specifically the time in the belly of the fish, that relates to events in Christ's life. He was himself a man of sign, the sign of the dove. And of course, this sign of the dove was also placed upon the one who, like Jonah, would spend time in the depths, overcome certain death, and be cast out of the grave. Turning back to Matthew chapter 3, verses 16 and 17. "And Jesus, when he was baptized, went up straightway out of the water. And lo, the heavens were opened unto him, and he saw the Spirit of God descending like a dove and lighting upon him. And lo, a voice from heaven saying, This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased." So here we see the dove, the sign of the dove, placed upon Jesus, who became that antitype of Jonah in all that he did. So going back to our initial word that we were discussing, this silent dove of mute justice among strangers, let's talk a little bit about how this dove was not just any dove, but one of silence or one of mute justice. I believe this phrase that is used here, this statement, references the sacrificial element of Christ through trial, as shown in verses such as Isaiah 53, verse 7. Let's look at that. Isaiah 53, verse 7. "He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He is brought as a lamb to the slaughter." Think about a dove being offered. "And as a sheep before her shears is dumb or silent, so he opened not his mouth." He was a silent lamb, a silent dove, so to speak. 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 21 and through 23. 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 21 through 23. "For even here too were ye called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us our example, that ye should follow his steps, who did no sin, neither was guile found in his mouth, who when he was reviled, reviled not again. When he suffered, he threatened not, but he committed himself to him that judgeth righteously." So here was Jesus, a silent dove. He had neither guile in his mouth. He reviled not again. He threatened not. Sort of goes back to what we were talking about at the end of Sunday school earlier today. Let's look at a few moments from the trial that highlight this fact. It's not that Jesus had no words throughout this trial. We know he did. But let's look at a few specific incidences that I think really relate to what's being taught here. Matthew chapter 26, verses 62 and 63. Matthew 26, 62 and 63. "And the high priest arose and said unto him, Answerest thou nothing? What is it which these witness against thee? But Jesus held his peace. And the high priest answered and said unto him, I adjure thee by the living God, that thou tell us whether thou be the Christ, the Son of God." Let's look at Matthew 27, verses 12 through 14. "And when he was accused of the chief priests and elders, he answered nothing. Then said Pilate unto him, Hearest thou not how many things they witness against thee? And he answered him to never a word, insomuch that the governor marveled greatly." We believe that this is clearly what's being referred to back in Psalm 56 as a silent dove of mute justice among strangers. All right. So lastly on this title, the part among strangers. Just as David was among strangers, and of course the psalm first relates to David, then to the Christ, so was Jesus. The Roman authorities in this case were the strangers. Certainly a power that was foreign to the land, but more broadly than just the Romans, Jesus, you might say, was a stranger throughout his entire life, even to his own family. Let's look at a few verses to back this up. Let's look at Matthew chapter 8, verses 19 and 20. A certain scribe came and said unto him, Master, I will follow thee whithersoever thou goest. And Jesus saith unto him, The foxes have holes, the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man hath not where to lay his head. Even all the way back to his birth, this is, you know, it's interesting, you know, where was he born? In very humble surroundings, not even in a house. Back in Luke chapter 2, verse 7, she brought forth her firstborn son and wrapped him in a swaddling clothes and laid him in a manger, because there was no room for them in the inn. Even as a baby, he was a stranger from the majority of people, born in the manger. And yet as he grew up, this only continued. Let's look at Psalm 69, verses 6 through 8. Psalm 69, verses 6 through 8. Let not them that wait on thee, O Yahweh God of hosts, be ashamed for my sake. Let not those that seek thee be confounded for my sake, O God of Israel. Because for thy sake I have borne reproach. Shame hath covered my face. I am become a stranger unto my brethren, and an alien to my mother's children. A stranger and an alien. Let's go to John chapter 1, verse 11. He came unto his own, but his own received him not. John 7, verse 5. For neither did his brethren believe in him. I know I'm skipping around back and forth from the Old New Testament, but we'll go back to Psalm 38, verse 11. Psalm 38, 11. My lovers and my friends stand aloof from my sore, and my kinsmen stand afar off. And then finally on this point, back in the Gospels, in Matthew 26, verse 56. Matthew 26, verse 56. But all this was done, that the scriptures of the prophets may be fulfilled. Then all the disciples forsook him and fled. So, as a baby at his birth, he was amongst strangers. You know, he wasn't in the inn. He was essentially with the animals, so to speak, and with his parents. When he was young, he was a stranger amongst his brethren. As he came into his ministry, he was a stranger again amongst his immediate family, amongst the people. And then in the end, even his friends, his disciples, forsook him and fled. Then he ended up with the true strangers to the Jewish nation, that being the Roman overlords. He was a silent dove among strangers. Now, obviously, we don't believe that Christ pre-existed or anything else, but we do believe that, again, he was sent directly from God. He was Yahweh's own son, and he was as a stranger throughout his whole life amongst men who did not understand the presence of the Son of God in their midst. Okay, so collectively we have seen, taken a good amount of time to do it on this word, but from Psalm 56, it was given to the chief musician as the prayer of a silent dove amongst strangers. It was engraved, miktam, upon the beloved, when those very strangers took him into the winepress, or gath, of judgment. Yet while the enemy would attempt to crush the silent dove, just as men would crush the grapes in times past, the beloved would pass through judgment and would be able to offer new wine. Matthew 9, verse 17. Matthew 9, verse 17. Neither do men put new wine into old bottles, else the bottles break, and the wine runneth out, and the bottles perish. But they put new wine into new bottles, and both are preserved. So the work of Christ, though it was completely understood, though he was among strangers, though he was put into a situation of mute justice, through his work, we know through his sacrificial work, the new way of Christ, the new and living way, which is symbolized by this new wine, was put forth. John chapter 15, verses 1 through 5. John chapter 15, verses 1 through 5. I am the true vine, Jesus says. My Father is the husbandman. Every branch in me that beareth not fruit, he taketh away, and every branch that beareth fruit, he purgeth it, that it may bring forth more fruit. Now ye are clean through the word that I have spoken unto you. Abide in me, and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit of itself, except it abide in the vine, no more can ye, except ye abide in me. I am the vine, ye are the branches. He that abideth in me, and I in him, the same bringeth forth much fruit. For without me, ye can do nothing. So we must be attached to this vine. We must be grafted in, so to speak, when we are baptized. We must grow and be pruned through our trials and so forth. But this new wine, this new way in Christ, was made possible only because he was the silent dove among strangers. Finally, let's turn to Luke 22, and let's look at 15 through 20. And this, of course, is a memorial account. And later this morning, you know, a lot of this talk will be preparing us for the memorials that we'll take up later. But we're going to eat bread and drink wine, literally, as symbols of this sacrifice. And he said unto them in verse 15, Luke 22, with desire I desire to eat this Passover with you before I suffer. For I say unto you, I will not any more drink, eat thereof, until it be fulfilled in the kingdom of God. And he took the cup and gave thanks and said, take this and divide it among yourselves. For I say unto you, I will not drink of the fruit of the vine until the kingdom of God shall come. And he took bread and gave thanks and brake it and gave to them, saying, this is my body which is given for you, this do in remembrance of me. Likewise also the cup after supper, saying, this cup is the new covenant in my blood, which is shed for you. All right, I'd like to turn back to Psalm 56 now. We read it earlier to start our meeting, so I was going to read through it now, but we already did that. So, with this, I think, very important background, it's probably unusual to spend half the talk on the introduction of the introductory statement, but I think it's very important to understand why this psalm was written and what it ultimately pointed to. Yes, it was given, initially composed by David. We believe it was a copying or the song version of his actual prayer. But it was something far more than that. It was a messianic psalm that points straight to Christ as the silent dove. Okay. As we went through this psalm, hopefully you'll remember, I'm going to point out some things. It is very clear that this was given to the chief musician for purposes of singing. Now, we don't have the music, we have the words, which is probably the most important part. But note just, for example, the repeated phrases. In verses 1 and 2, we see twice the references to being swallowed up and those that fight against the psalmist. So we say, be merciful unto me, O God, for man would swallow me up. He fighteth daily, oppresseth me. Mine enemies would daily swallow me up, for they be many that fight against me, O thou most high. There's a repetition in the psalm, in this psalm. There's also, we believe, what probably is the stanza or the theme of the chapter is repeated twice. In verse 4, it says, in God I will praise his word. In God I have put my trust. I will not fear what flesh can do unto me. And then again in verses 10 and 11, in God will I praise his word. In the Lord will I praise his word. In God have I put my trust. I will not be afraid what man can do unto me. So if you look at it, there are some very, I'm sure if I was a Hebrew scholar, I'd probably see more than I can just from the English, but there are some repetitive phrases here that give us some extra thought of how this might have been composed as a song, with the main stanza or the main theme, just like a lot of our, especially when we do anthems, there's usually a repeated statement. The repeated statement here, that's sort of the central theme, is what's in verse 4 and verses 10 and 11. Remember, and this should make sense if you remember some of the work of our past studies of this subject. Remember that this is the prayer of David when he finally came to amidst his own time of distress. Remember, he had been making some pretty bad decisions. They were driven by the fear of man. They brought these decisions, first the fear of Saul, then the fear of Achish, brought him low into figurative madness. So it would make sense that a central theme of the psalm here is, in God will I praise his word, in the Lord I will praise his word, in God have I put my trust, I will not be afraid what man can do unto me. And then, you know, as verse 3, what time I am afraid, I will put my trust in thee. This is where David woke up and he realized where he had gone so amiss. All right, so what are the first words of David in this song, this prayer? Be merciful unto me, O God. He realizes his need for mercy, which might simply be defined as the withholding of that which David deserved due to his actions. Grace complements mercy. Mercy is the withholding of something that is deserved. Judgment upon us, the wages of sin is death. Grace is the extending of unmerited favor, the giving of something that is not deserved. They're parallel concepts, but from opposite directions. David realized that he needed mercy from Yahweh. His own foolishness had brought him into this state of literal madness, and spiritual madness as well. But Yahweh's mercy could withdraw him from this self-made situation described in 1 Samuel 21. David's refrain is then followed by a repetitive stanza. As I mentioned earlier, twice in verses 1 and 2, we see similar phrases. He says, swallow me up. And twice he mentions man fighting against him. These are interesting words. In the Hebrew, the phrase swallow me up literally means to feed on or to consume. It comes from a root meaning to inhale eagerly. The words for fighting and fight here in the first verses mean also to feed on or consume. They're very similar words. So we honestly get a picture here. David describes his situation as that of the prey before a predatory animal. First Saul and now the Philistines were his predators, desiring to inhale, feed on, consume David, to destroy him forever. Likewise, we can see how Jesus may have felt as the Jewish and Roman leaders came against him. First the Jews, then the Gentiles. Let's look at Psalm 22, verses 12 and 13. Psalm 22, verses 12 and 13. Many bulls have compassed me. Strong bulls of Bashan have beset me round about. They gaped upon me with their mouths as a ravening and a roaring lion. So again, think of the predatory animal. And David is crying out for mercy. Jesus would cry out for mercy from Yahweh to save him from the roaring lion. In verses 20 and 21, likewise, we see, deliver my soul from the, or my life from the sword, my darling from the power of the dog. Save me from the lion's mouth, for thou hast heard me from the horns of the unicorns. Returning to Psalm 56, verses 3 and 4 continue by comparing the principles of fear and trust. What time I am afraid, I will trust in thee. In God I will praise his word. In God I have put my trust. I will not fear what flesh can do unto me. Remember, the fear of man was what had brought David into this mess in the first place. And we've read of that a multitude of times in Psalm 21 verses, not for Psalm, 1 Samuel 21 verses 10 through 12. David, though, understood now his folly. He had woken up to what the fear of man brings had brought him to. Remember Proverbs 29:25, which we've referred to many times, the fear of man bringeth a snare. David now understood he should have been guided by the fear of Yahweh all along, a fear that inspires both reverence and trust. We'd like to look at several other verses that connect all these principles in the Psalms specifically. Let's look at Psalm 31, verse 19. Psalm 31, verse 19. Again, a psalm of David. He says, O how great is thy goodness, which thou hast laid up for them that fear thee, which thou hast wrought for them that trust in thee before the sons of men. So again, fear of the Lord, connection to trust in the Lord. Psalm 40, verse 3. Psalm 40, verse 3. He has put a new song in my mouth, praise unto our God. Many shall see it and fear, and shall trust in Yahweh. See, fear, trust. Psalm 115, verse 11. Psalm 115, verse 11. Ye that fear Yahweh, trust in Yahweh. He is their help and their shield. And then I have one last verse that's not a psalm. Isaiah 50, verse 10. Isaiah 50, verse 10. Who is among you that feareth Yahweh, that obeys the voice of his servant, that walketh in darkness and hath no light? Let him trust in the name of the Lord and stay upon his God. So those who fear Yahweh are to trust in him. And the fear of the Lord should bring that trust. These are principles that David had to learn and that Jesus understood. Back in Psalm 56, verses 5 and 6 continue with a reflective thought about David's enemies, the fear of whom had brought David into the troubles he found himself in. David says that they would wrest his words, which means to carve, fabricate, or fashion. Carve, fabricate, or fashion. In other words, David's enemies made up lies and ran with them. Their thoughts and actions were all against him. Think of Saul and all of his false accusations put against David. And then he not only lied about David to everyone else, but he then used those same false accusations as a reasoning for his own murderous pursuit. So too with Jesus. His enemies were on every side. They waited to entrap him almost constantly. We'll read a few verses in a second, but we continually see these references to the scribes and the Pharisees trying to entrap him, trying to just hang around on the outskirts just to see if they could see something or hear something that they could use for their own advantage. They tried to hunt his life out of their own wicked pretenses and lies. So let's turn to Matthew 22, verse 15. Matthew 22, 15. Then went the Pharisees and took counsel how they might entangle him in his talk. How they might entangle him in his talk. Luke, Gospel of Luke, chapter 11, 53 through 54. And as he said these things unto them, the scribes and the Pharisees began to urge him vehemently and to provoke him to speak of many things, laying wait for him and seeking to catch something out of his mouth that they might accuse him. They had no interest in really what he was saying or what he was teaching. They only had interest in trapping the Lord Jesus. Luke 20, verse 20. Luke 20, 20. And they watched him, and they sent forth spies, which should feign themselves just men, that they might take hold of his words, so they might deliver him to the power and authority of the governor. And then back to Matthew at the end of his life in chapter 26. Matthew 26, verses 3 and 4. Then assembled together the chief priests and the scribes and the elders of the people to the palace of the high priest that was called Caiaphas, and consulted that they might take Jesus by subtlety and kill him. So truly, we see, just like David talked about those who would wrest his words, who would fabricate things about him in order to entrap him and ultimately kill him, so too with the silent dove of Jesus among strangers. Psalm 56, verse 7. We see here that David petitions Yahweh for his judgments upon his enemies. He rhetorically asks a question. He asks if his enemies will escape judgment by their actions, and in turn asks for them to be brought down. This actually reminds us of David's statements in a previous psalm, Psalm 55, and we'll look at a couple verses there. Not that far away from Psalm 56. Let's look at 55. starting at verse 9. Destroy, O Lord, and divide their tongues, for I have seen violence and strife in the city. Verse 15. Let death seize upon them, and let them go down quick into the grave, for wickedness is in their dwellings and among them. Verse 23. But thou, O God, shall bring them down into the pit of destruction. Bloody and deceitful men shall not live out half their days, but I will trust in thee. I will trust in thee. Again, this is one of those Mashil psalms, or Miktam psalms. Incorrect, I said that wrong. This was a Mashil, not a Miktam. But in any case, the verses still relate to this principle. Again, in Psalm 56, David here is asking what's going to happen to his enemies. Shall they escape? And while I think we certainly have to balance this with what we were talking about in Sunday school about, you know, showing mercy to our brethren, in this case, these are to those enemies that had defied Yahweh. Were they going to escape? And I think the perspective matters a lot here, is that yes, while David was personally trapped, personally pursued, and so forth, ultimately what David cared about, and even more so what Christ cared about, was the glory of God, was the glory of Yahweh, and what, and all of the wrong that was being done in terms of the truth. But Saul was a wicked leader who had brought many people astray. The Jews of Christ's time were wicked leaders who had brought many astray. Could they escape judgment? So there's a rhetorical question. We'd like to turn now over to Matthew 23, because similarly, Christ has a rhetorical question when he talks about his enemies, the scribes and the Pharisees. Matthew 23, verses 29 to 39. Starting in verse 29. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you build the tombs of the prophets and garnish the sepulchres of the righteous, and say, if we had been in the days of our fathers, we would not have been partakers with them in the blood of the prophets. Wherefore ye be witnesses to yourselves that ye are the children of them that killed the prophets. Fill ye then up the measure of your fathers. And here's the rhetorical question, just like David asked in Psalm 56. Ye serpents, ye generation of vipers, how can ye escape the damnation of the grave? How can ye escape the damnation of the grave? Wherefore, behold, I send unto you prophets and wise men and scribes, and some of them ye shall kill and crucify. Some of them shall ye scourge in your synagogues and persecute them from city to city, that upon you may come the righteous blood, all the righteous blood shed upon the earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zacharias, son of Berechiah, whom you slew, or will say, between the temple and the altar. Verily I say unto you, all these things shall come upon this generation. And this is the generation we've been speaking about in Sunday school. AD 70 was going to be the end of these things. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, thou that killest the prophets, stonest them which are sent unto thee, how often would I have gathered thy children together, even as a hen gathereth her chickens under her wings, and you would not. Behold, your house is left unto you desolate. For I say unto you, ye shall not see me henceforth, till ye shall say, Blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord. So we notice, again, that both David and Christ utilize a rhetorical question when talking about their enemies. David asked, would his enemies escape? Jesus asked, how can ye escape the condemnation of the grave? For Saul, for Achish, the scribes and the Pharisees, the answer was assuredly no. None of them could escape. Back in Psalm 56, continuing in verse 8, David first says, Thou tellest my wanderings. Thou tellest my wanderings. This phrase, thou tellest, means to score with a mark, a tally or record or inscribe. So again, thou tellest means to score with a mark, tally or record, inscribe. Does David trust that a record is being kept of his wanderings? A tally was being inscribed by God. Obviously, we have a literal record of these things, quite interestingly, in the books of Samuel, Kings, and Chronicles, which are in and of themselves an inscribed record of the trials of David. Not all of them, but some major ones. But more importantly, the trials of David and his responses to them were being kept as a record or tally inscribed by God. His tears and times of sorrow were captured, figuratively filling up a bottle, as he says here, "Thou keepest my tears in a bottle." Just like Jesus' strong crying and tears were also captured and heard. Let's look at Hebrews 5:7. I know we've referenced this recently in another context. Psalm 5, verse 7. "Who in the days of his flesh, when he had offered up prayers and supplications with strong crying and tears unto him that was able to save him from death, and was heard, and that he feared." So David's tears were heard and were collected, so to speak. His trials, his wanderings, were marked or recorded. Back in the psalm, David specifically mentions thy book. Well, what book is this? We believe this is a reference to the book of remembrance that records the work of Yahweh's saints, as shown in Malachi 3:16. Malachi 3:16. "Then they that feared Yahweh spake often one to another, and the Yahweh hearkened and heard it, and a book of remembrance was written before him for them that feared the Lord and that thought upon his name." So we have the book of remembrance, in which we believe, I think it fits well with Psalm 56, verse 8, the wanderings of the saints are recorded, so to speak. There is a mark, a tally, a record, an inscription, however you want to say it. Of course, those who are remembered in this book of remembrance for their faithfulness through trial will ultimately be found in another book, the book of life. Let's look at Revelation, and we'll look at three different verses here. We'll start with chapter 20, verse 12. "And I saw the dead, small and great, stand before God, and the books were opened. And another book was opened," so there's multiple books, "and another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged out of those things that were written in the books according to their works." So again, things written in the books are used for judgment, but ultimately what's the key thing is that your name is written in the book of life. This is talking about the end of the thousand-year period, but we believe it also would apply to the beginning of the thousand-year period for the first judgment. Let's look at Revelation 3, verse 5. Revelation 3, verse 5. "He that overcometh, the same shall be clothed in white raiment," representing their righteousness, their cleanness. "But continuing on, I will not blot his name out with the book of life." Again, our ultimate hope for each of us, we all have many hopes surrounding the hope of Israel, but we all desire our name to not be blotted out of the book of life. "But I will confess his name before my Father and before his angels." None of us are perfect. We all have failures, and we need Yahweh's mercy. We need to approach him for forgiveness of sins and so forth. We need to continually be cleansed. But ultimately, we desire that book of remembrance, that inscription, so to speak, of our wanderings to be full of a good record and not a bad record. Such that through Yahweh's grace we may be found in the book of life. Revelation 21:27. "And there shall in no wise enter into it anything that defileth, neither whatsoever worketh abomination or maketh a lie." And this is talking about the New Jerusalem, the holy city, and the spiritual city that Yahweh is composing. "But they which..." Those that are part of the New Jerusalem, those they are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. Okay. In Psalm 56, verse 9, David acknowledges that his enemies would be turned back. So he had asked rhetorically. He had written this verse that's about his wanderings being recorded, his tears being captured, and so forth. And then he goes back and he acknowledges, yes, His enemies would be turned back. And when David cried out to Yahweh, and of course this is quite fitting because literally when this initial prayer is written, he is crying out to Yahweh for salvation from the Philistines. David had previously been so caught up in the fear of man that he had completely lost his way. He had become a literal madman, greatly humbled before a pagan king, and more importantly, the king of the universe. In turn, however, thankfully, this led to a change of thoughts and ultimate salvation, as he started, "Be merciful unto me, O God." Verses 10 and 11 once again repeat the main theme or stanza of the song, revolving around David's praise of God, his word, and the trust that the young man had in the Almighty, a trust which alone could help him conquer the fear of man within. Note that throughout this entire psalm, I thought this was an interesting point, we see the English word God used, meaning Elohim in the Hebrew. David thus recognized that the angels were Yahweh's ministers that could work in his life to save him while also casting down the wicked. However, when this stanza is used the second time, it's almost like he comes to a climax here. In verse 10, he specifically uses not God or Elohim, but he uses the memorial name of Yahweh, translated Lord, for it is ultimately him alone that brings deliverance and deserves all of the praise. So if we see that this central theme of the song is repeated or sung, up to that point he uses references to the Elohim, but at that second climax of this sort of key theme, he uses the name of Yahweh instead as a reference to the memorial name, as not only the climax here for the second use of the stanza, but also as giving credit to where it is ultimately due, to Yahweh himself. Going into verse 12, I'd like to read a few other versions that might help with our understanding, because I think it's easier in some of the other translations. This is verse 12, and I'll turn back to it and just read what it says in the KJV first. I could be wrong about this, but I sort of look at verses 12 and 13 sort of like a postscript, if you will, to the psalm, sort of his thoughts after the fact. So basically with all these things in mind, David now says, "Thy vows are upon me, O God, I will render praises unto thee." Let's look at this other translation. ESV states, "I must perform my vows to you." The NET says, "I am obligated to fulfill the vows I made unto you." So I just thought that was a little bit easier to understand. Instead of "thy vows are upon me," "I must perform my vows to you. I am obligated to fulfill the vows I made to you." David thus reminds himself of his high and holy calling, encouraged in the fear of Yahweh. As I mentioned, I sort of look at verses 12 and 13, hopefully correctly, but I can't say for sure, as sort of a postscript where David is looking back on his prayer having been answered. And that'll become even further to light in verse 13, which we'll get to in a few minutes. David here, though, in verse 12, having been saved, in my mind anyway, he says that "I must perform my vows to you." His high and holy calling is in the forefront of his mind. He has been brought out of this state of madness. He has been brought out of a situation of certain death, and now he is rededicating his life to Yahweh as it should have been. Whether he lived or died, he was dedicated to Yahweh, his Redeemer, just like Jesus would be many generations later. "I will keep my vows. I must perform my vows." I'm going to look at a few other psalms for some parallel verses here. Psalm 22, verse 25. We referenced Psalm 22 earlier with regards to the lion's mouth. But in verse 25 it says, "My praise shall be of thee in the great congregation. I will pay my vows before them that fear him. So Psalm 22, very messianic, obviously, has the similar statement here. I will pay my vows. Psalm 61, verse 8. Psalm 61, 8. We also read from this chapter earlier. So will I sing praise unto thy name forever, that I may daily perform my vows. Psalm 66, verse 13. 66, verse 13. I will go into thy house with my burnt offerings. I will pay thee my vows. Psalm 116, verse 14. I will pay my vows unto Yahweh now, the presence of all his people. Verse 18 in that same chapter. I will pay my vows unto Yahweh now in the presence of all his people. So again, David has been brought into this state of madness. He cries out for mercy. He puts his trust in Yahweh, and Yahweh redeems him. He will pay his vows. He is rededicating his life to the things of the truth. He realizes how badly he's messed up. Now we get to the final verse in the psalm, Psalm 56, verse 13. For thou hast delivered my life from death. So this one, whether you view verse 10 and 11, that second repetitious section, as the end of the song, and these the last two verses as sort of his postscript, or you just view verse 13 as his postscript, verse 13 is definitely looking backwards. For thou hast, past tense, delivered my soul from the grave, from death. Wilt thou not deliver my feet from falling, that I may walk before God in the light of the living? So this looks both backwards and forwards in a way. This is a jubilant verse where we see David's redemption from certain death in Gath was complete, and he escaped to the cave of Adullam. His life, which looked like it had been at an end, had been delivered from the door of death. And now he could joyfully walk in the light of the living. When put to song, again, if they have the original prayer and you have these verses added, we can imagine if this is part of the song, it would have been a jubilant climax. So you have the final stanza where he brings out the name of Yahweh, and then this is sort of the end in jubilation. Interestingly, this phrase is also found in another psalm with an unknown author, where it was either repeated anonymously by David, which is possible, or picked up by another author who refers back to Psalm 56. Either way, if you go back to Psalm 116, let's look at verses 8 and 9. For thou hast delivered my soul from death, mine eyes from tears, my feet from falling. I will walk before Yahweh in the land of the living. Going up a few verses to Psalm 116, verse 1 in this psalm, we see a similar situation with the writer saying that he loved Yahweh, who had heard his voice. As we've mentioned off and on this morning, while Psalm 56 was primarily written regarding David's life experience in Gath, it has been typical of the Lord Jesus in his mindset throughout his trials. Jesus was a man who loved the Lord, who loved Yahweh, who has heard of Yahweh, and whose life was in turn delivered from death to the light of the living. If you go back, I'm going to get into some of the some more discussion of the Christ. But if you look in Psalm 56, verse 13, I mentioned that there's both a past, an aspect of him looking backwards and an aspect of him looking forwards. Thou hast delivered my soul from death. This is uttered after salvation has been achieved. Salvation from Gath, salvation from Achish, freedom from the Philistines. But it's interesting that even though, yes, David had been given the opportunity to walk before God once more in the light of the living. There is a rhetorical question here. Wilt thou not deliver my feet from falling that I may walk before God in the light of the living? I can't help but think that here David is looking to not just only the freedom that he has just received, but also not only the freedom that he has received, but also the ultimate freedom that he desired, to walk before God in the light of the living, the light of eternal life. So again, just to put that in, recap that real quickly. In verse 13, he looks backwards at his deliverance from the Philistines. Yes, he is given a new opportunity to walk before God, but ultimately, what does David desire? He desires to walk before God in the light of the living, which I believe focuses mainly on that book. He wants to be found in the book of life. He wants to walk before Yahweh forever. Throughout all of this incident, we know that David went through a typical death, burial, and resurrection. He was raised up to life after an almost certain death. Jesus, of course, experienced this as well, quite literally, through his death, burial, and resurrection. Let's look first at Job 33, and we'll look at a few verses there to describe this process. And it's quite a beautiful set of verses when you think about resurrection. Job 33, let's start at verse 24 through 30. Then he is gracious unto him, and saith, deliver him from going down to the pit. I have found a ransom. His flesh shall be fresher than a child's. He shall return to the days of his youth. He shall pray unto God, and he will be favorable unto him. He shall see his face with joy. He will render unto man his righteousness. He looketh upon men, and if any say, I have sinned, and perverted that which was right, and it profited me not, he will deliver his life from going into the pit. His life shall see the light. And think of the light of the living. His life shall see the light. When? When he is raised and given immortality. Lo, all these things worketh God oftentimes with man, to bring back his life from the pit, to be enlightened with the light of the living. Mark well, O Job, hearken unto me, hold thy peace, and I will speak. If thou hast anything to say, answer me. Speak, for I desire to justify thee. If not, hearken unto me, hold thy peace, and I shall teach thee wisdom. So I believe these are some of the words of Elihu, who was the righteous one, who came in after Job's other three friends. But here we see this description of resurrection, and David most likely is using this phrase taken from Job when he describes in Psalm 56 the light of the living. So when he says at the end of Psalm 56 that I may walk before God in the light of the living, again, he's already been redeemed from Gath at this point. What does he seek? He seeks what's being talked about in the book of Job. He seeks immortality. He seeks to overcome this flesh completely, having kept his vows, having had an acceptable record in the book of remembrance, and having been found in the book of life. All right, let's go now to Psalm 31, and I realize this is a long talk. I'm wrapping it up shortly. Psalm 31, verses 3 through 5. A psalm of David, he says here, for thou art my rock and my fortress. Therefore, for thy name's sake, lead me and guide me. Pull me out of the net that they have privily laid for me, for thou art my strength. Into thy hand I commit my spirit, or my life. Thou hast redeemed me, O Yahweh, God of truth. We'll discuss this more in the memorials, but we know, of course, these were part of the last words spoken by Jesus himself. Into thy hands I commit my spirit or my life. Yet what did he seek? Like David in Psalm 56, he sought to overcome, to be able to live again in the light of the living, not just in mortality, but in immortality, as described in the book of Job. So now we finally come to the end of our thoughts on 1 Samuel 21, I mean at this time, as well as Psalms 34 and 56. So it's associated Psalms. So really, we looked at 1 Samuel 21, Psalm 34, Psalm 56. They are all an intertwined subject. We have seen David, like Jesus, spied on in the house of God. We have seen David, like Jesus, pursued by the wicked leaders of his people. We have seen David, like Jesus, endure the darkness of foreign leaders. We have seen David, like Jesus, in a state likened to certain death. Yet we have also seen David, like Jesus, cry out to Yahweh. We have seen David, like Jesus, be heard by his God. Again, the strong crying and tears, the tears that were put in a bottle. We have seen David, like Jesus, put in a cave, brought to a cave. And yet we have seen David, like Jesus, redeemed from destruction. And, finally, David, like Jesus, giving praise to Yahweh for all he had done and bringing him into the hope of the light of the living. Jesus has attained unto the light of the living, eternal life. David looked to it when he uttered this psalm. And though he is dead in faith, we have no doubt he will attain unto it in a future day. So with that said, we'll conclude our talk and move forward into the memorials.